You're listening to the Wheeler Centre podcast. In this episode, we'll hear from the co-founders and leaders of Black Lives Matter with Patrice Cullors and Rodney Develis in conversation with Jack Lattimore. Before we get started, just a note, we'll hear some explicit language as Jack, Patrice and Rodney talk about online hate speech. Now let's get started with a welcome to country from Auntie Carolyn Briggs.
Hello, my name's Carolyn Briggs and I'm the Ngawit of this area as known as Yalakut Willem of the Bun Wurrung language group. And I'm here to welcome you, or Womanjika. So, firstly, I'd like to pay my respects to the land that we now stand and also pay my respects to my ancestors who are with me and also to my elders, both past and present, and to any elders that may be in the audience tonight. Womanjika, Merambikbik, Bunurong, Namdep, Barupton, Arthur Willem. That means welcome to our beautiful home, the lands of the two great bays, Nerm being Port Phillip Bay and Meran being Western Port Bay. And it is a welcome to you, and it's a welcome to all of you for coming on to our beautiful country to talk about the issues that impact us all. And it is about Black Lives Matters, and it's about all people's lives matters, and it's about that connection. And as you are guests to on our country, and as we are the descendants of the First Peoples of Melbourne, of the Yalakut Willem of the Bun Wurrung language group of the Greater Kulin Nation, we welcome you all here tonight and extend our hand in friendships with the friends and staff of the Wheeler Centre and the Sydney Peace Prize. Tonight we acknowledge the traditional lands of the Yalakut Willem of the Bun Wurrung language group. Yalakut Willem means the people of the river which flowed out into our Great Bay. The Bun Wurrung people were a part of a much larger nation known as Kulin. The Kulin nation consisted of five major language groups, and they were out to our neighbours, the Woiwurrung, the Tan Wurrung, the Jaja Wurrung, and the Wath Wurrung. Wurrung is how you speak of country, how you speak of self. So like I said, it's about how you talk country as you talk yourself. The word Bun Wurrung means to speak with no lips. When that meant that anyone entering our country should speak the language as a sign of respect. It is now over 180 years since the Europeans first arrived in this area we now call Melbourne. The Sacred River, which flows past us, is now called the Yarra River, but it was known by our people as the Birrarung. Translates means the River of Mist. The Birrarung was not only a source for food and transport, it represented the lifeblood of the Kulin Nation as it flowed into our Great Bay, known as Nerm or Port Phillip Bay. Today we stand together on this special country and share the respect with each other's cultures and heritage. In recognising that and celebrating our shared history, we all have something to gain. In traditional society of the Kulin people, we were committed to the maintenance of our society by valuing the importance of learning, showing respect, celebrating life, and honouring sacred ground. And as we talk about the honouring of the learning of sacred, about the learning was a transmission of knowledge that an understanding that ensured our culture survived. This commitment to learning has been a part of every generation since time began. And it's one of the reasons why we are still strong today. And we're measuring our time at what we believe is 50,000 years. Showing respect. In our traditions, visitors were always welcome, but they were required to show respects to the laws of this country. The same way we share respect to each other's diversity, cultures, religious or spiritual beliefs today. And it is about a celebration of coming together, sharing stories and empowering the strength. But it's about the celebration of life, the arrival of new children, the coming of our six seasons. The visiting of the neighbouring clans was a very much an important part of our life. And today Melbourne not only represents one of the most important places for the celebration of contemporary Indigenous arts and culture, it also celebrates our multicultural and global society. Respecting sacred ground. We should all acknowledge the sacred ground on which we stand. And Melbourne today is a host to many people from many different nations, and we still call upon them to continue to respect the sacred ground by understanding the history and the heritage of the First Peoples of Melbourne. And what we celebrate tonight through this coming together through the Wheeler Centre and the Sydney Prize is the ongoing commitment to the spirit of generosity, which remains a very much important part of our culture. And today it is my hope that we can all take pride in our shared history and celebrate the strength of our great nations. And according to our traditions, our lands will always be protected by our creator, Bunjil, who travels as an eagle, and by Wan, who protects our waterways, travels as a crow. Bunjil taught us to always welcome guests, but he required us to ask all visitors to make a number of promises or commitments, not to harm the lands and waters and not harm the children of Bunjil. And this commitment is made through an exchange of a small vow dipped in the water of the land. So once again, Wormanjiga, Marambikbik, Bunurong, Namde, Barupton, Ato Willem. So it is about understanding. One of the points that I talked about is about showing respect. And one of those is when you go into other people's country, you pay respects to the lands by understanding that there's a word when you go to different places that's about connecting to those communities. You try to take on the language of the place that you're a part of at that moment. So I'm going to ask you all to say, Wormanjiga.
Wormanjiga.
You can do it louder than that. I know Melbourne can. Melbourne's out there. Wormanjiga.
Wormanjiga.
I want you to do that every day so that you articulate 2,000 generations of my ancestors' language. And it is about embracing that as your part of your, not hello, g'day, whatever else we say, but it's all about embracing the language of the land and connecting to that land and remembering the ancestors and celebrating those ancestors that gave you the opportunities to create your strength within this identity of this land. So we're here to celebrate this amazing journey that will take you to open your hearts and understand about the human relationships and understanding those impacts that are happening around us all the time. So means to come. Ask to come, and what is your purpose or what is your intention for coming? There's a question, and that's what it means. It's not just welcome. Nungunji.
They just keep getting better. I assume you deliver one with Uncle Jack, that was Jack Charles, and that was pretty amazing, but that one was stirring. Look, before we begin, I'd like personally to acknowledge traditional owners, the Boomerang Elders, past and present, who are gathered on their country tonight, and I'd also like to acknowledge the elders of any other nations that have joined us here. Let's begin. I want to introduce Patrice Cullors, Black Lives Matter founder, and also Rodney Deverlis, founder of the BLM Toronto chapter. give them a welcome. These guys have had a hectic week. So I'm going to give a little bit of a reprieve to begin with and tell a story about place and work our way into this discussion tonight. So back before the invasion of this country commenced in the early 1800s, just up the river here, about 3 furlongs towards Federation Square, about where the Queen's Bridge sits, there was a little waterfall. It was only about 1 metre drop at low tide and no more than a few inches at high tide. But it was enough to divide the river into 2 sections, the upper and the lower, and it's significant for 2 reasons. Firstly, it provided a meeting place for the local mob. My understanding is that the river ran between the Woiwurrung lands on the north bank and the Boomerang lands on this side. And for millennia, it was a site of exchange, a site for communication, and it was also a natural bridge between people. And the second reason why it's significant is that the upper section was fresh water and the lower was brine. And that was the reason that the white invaders settled in what became known as Melbourne. We got Batman, Evans and Faulkner. They set up shop. That was around 1835. The water was crystal clear on both sections of the Birrarung. By the early 1880s, the water quality was sufficiently putrid enough that a royal commission was launched after the white colonialists began contracting diphtheria and typhoid. And that was largely due to shitting into their own drinking supply of water. Later that decade, they blasted the falls away. In the late 1800s, an old fellow named Barak told a story about the river that runs by the front of this building. That story goes that there were 2 boys playing in the bush. They were throwing spears, whatever they saw. And as they were playing, they came up to an old tree, and in the hope of finding some gum or some honey up top, they began climbing. They looked down. One of the boys seen a hole just beneath the tree. So he climbed down, he put his spear into the hole, thinking that, you know, there might be something in there. And there was something. There was an old man, a spirit. He came out and he grabbed one of the boys and dragged him. And where he dragged him, that's where the river runs. And then Bunjil, he heard the boy screaming and he come down. And he got rid of the old man. And he said to him, "Let this be a lesson to all men. Be good to children." So, in that spirit of place, where we're sitting right now is a place known locally as Jeff Shed. It's the folly of a former Victorian Premier named Jeff Kennett. He presided over this state through the 1990s. And the construction was considered probably some sort of economic stimulus to claw Victoria out of that era's recession. Also, well, in 1996, I was living up north around this period, southeast Queensland, and up there, the recession yielded a different political phenomenon, and that was Pauline Hanson. Now, her maiden speech as probably most of you will remember or have revisited, it was just vile, raw bigotry, particularly towards blackfellas and Asians. It was also incendiary. It struck a pleasing note for many more Australians across the country than most of you would care to admit. Much of the same sort of social climate as today, 2 decades on. Now, at the height of this racist fanfare, Jeff Kennett swaggered out, I remember it well, and he publicly condemned Pauline Hanson. And he said, "Victoria, I will chase racism down every burrow." And I recall thinking at the time, well, that's where it thrives and festers out of sight. Being as pale as I am, I'm often inadvertently privy to some pretty raw bigotry. The type that fueled the emergence of Pauline Hanson's One Nation Party. And it routinely comes out of the mouths of those that you'd at least expect it from. These days, those same sentiments thrive in our most prominent and immediate media. A year or so on after the death of that young fella out in Kalgoorlie, I was sent some images by an Indigenous ex-collaborator. But before we look at them, for those unfamiliar with the death of that young fella, I'll just do a quick recap. A 56-year-old white fella chased and ran over the top of him in a 2-ton four-wheel drive. The boy was trying to escape on a little peewee motorbike, a 70cc, that the killer claimed that the boy had stolen. What happened following the charges was that when it went to court, a jury at the Supreme Court of Western Australia found that the boy's death was not manslaughter, but a case of dangerous driving causing death. 10 minutes after they decided that, the chief judge of the court came out and sentenced the 56-year-old driver to 3 years jail. That driver will finish his sentence before Elijah would have finished high school. If granted parole, and there's every suggestion that he will be, the killer will be released 8 months from now. Now, that case in Australia brought Black Lives Matter movement to the fore. If we can get those slides up, I'm just going to read you a couple. These are slides not from then, but from last week. This is from Alice Springs, not Kalgoorlie. I'll just read a couple in case you can't see. We just need a vigilante group to drive around between 11 p.m. and 3 p.m, just flogging the fuck out of any cunts that are congregating around the town. Put fear in these little fuckers that the police can't. I have no problem driving by and seeing these little cunts getting a beating. Beep and wave. Set a trap, catch them red-handed, zip-tie them and drop them off a few k's out of town. Put the fear of God into them, then tell them to take the long walk home. This is last week. Why don't you accelerate and run over the little pricks? It would be smarter just to catch them, break a finger or two, and not post anything about it. They think people will be at the show, get out the wasp spray and spray them in the face. They'll have to go to hospital for treatment and the cops can get them there. Drown them good in the face. This is an open forum. So anyway, before we get to discussing things, you guys have come over, you've arrived in Australia. And if we can get to that other slide, John, with the about Black Lives Matter. This was a tweet put out by SBS News about your event in Sydney the other night. And these were some of the responses. Funny stuff how racist this is. BLM are a terrorist organisation that kills police officers. Hail Hitler, you dirty black monkeys. This group is nothing more than a racist terrorist organisation. Such an evil, racist group, you only have to look at the US to see all the hate, racism and destruction they bring. And another one that isn't on there is that hashtag all lives matter. So I guess my first question tonight, do all lives matter? Why do some matter a little bit more than others?
Thank you, Jack. Keeping it real, real.
Keeping it real.
I just want to thank everybody here and thank the traditional owners of this land, both past and present. It's been a powerful trip. You hear fatigue in my voice, but I'm super present, super present. And I know this is our last hurrah, and grateful that we get to do it here in Melbourne. So, I mean, before I get to your question, I actually want to comment or just like reflect on what you just shared with the audience, because I think it's really important. We receive a significant amount of hatred, hate mail, hate messages all the time. And I know that, I think it was a day before, a couple days before we received the prize, the Sydney Peace Foundation let us know that lots of, you know, they receive hate mail, hate messages, and it was all coming from the U.S. Mm-hmm. So I was like, I'm safe here, I think. I think it's a reality that we don't talk about often as organizers. I think if we really sat and thought about the kinds of vitriol that we receive, I don't think we'd do the work that we do. It'd feel too frightening. But I do think there are moments where I sit back and I read those types of comments, and I'm just like, wow, it's actually scary. Mm-hmm. It's scary to do our work. There's risk that it takes. And all lives matter, sure. Yes, they do, because they do. And I think the question about all lives mattering is the wrong question to be asking. I think the question is about who's suffering, who's been suffering, whose communities are systematically sought after for demise, whose communities are left to fend for themselves, whose communities have no resources and in fact are purposefully under-resourced. And as we start to ask those questions, then we see that it's Black people around the world. And that if we have a conversation about Black people and their freedom, it's actually having a conversation about everybody and their freedom. And we deeply believe that when Black people get free, we all get a little bit more free. So when someone says all lives matter, they're not saying all lives matter. Mm-hmm. What they're actually saying by that comment is Black lives don't matter. Mm-hmm. It's an intervention we must make in our work to center Blackness unapologetically.
Rodney.
Yo.
A recent trip to Mildura, we were having dinner, and we discussed over the dinner how America, North America, has a genuine fear of a Black planet. Mm-hmm. They genuinely fear that there will be a Black uprising, mm-hmm. and perhaps it's got something to do with the arms that are available or whatever. Mm-hmm. That immediacy, is that present? Like, we heard that it is mm-hmm. now, but that night I was arguing that it's a slower sort of project in Australia, the way that they're erasing our lives.
Yeah.
There's an ongoing colonial project. Mm-hmm. I've kind of shifted after I've been sent that stuff. I think, mm-hmm. you know, we've had a lot of deaths in custody, another spate of them. In Mildura, we heard about the spate of suicides mm-hmm. that community had recently. I'm kind of shifted. I think we're pretty immediate too. Mm-hmm. What's your reading of the different contexts between what you're seeing stateside and what you're seeing here?
I also agree with you that I think it's pretty immediate here. You know, I can only speak for my limited experience here, which is 11 days, I believe. And I know that, you know, folks here are born here, have families here, have multi-generations of people still living here. And I think that from my assessment that it is pretty immediate. I think that, the conversation that we were having was around this genuine fear amongst white folks primarily, amongst institutions, of Black people gaining power. And I think about it in the terms of a metaphor. If, you know, I came to your house and I was violent and tried to kill you and took it and said, that's mine, and actually just pushed you aside in the cold and told you to figure it out, and took the house for myself and chilled with my family and knew that you were outside in the cold but like never really paid attention to you or the fact that you were cold, I'd be afraid that you'd come back for your house as well. So I feel like, really, I'd sit there thinking, it's true. I'd think every day of my life, no, he's outside there. He's going to come get his house back at one point. So I think that the genuine fear is rooted in the fact that white folks still are living with the generational guilt of that the house isn't theirs. I think white folks, I think white communities, as power is being harnessed, as we're building these like massive civilizations of the future, as we are, really, as our communities are, whether it's the U.S. or in Europe or Canada or Australia, are feeling good about, our 200, 300 plus year civilizations versus the like tens of thousands of years of other civilizations. I think that there's a genuine fear that when black folks actually get together, when black folks actually harness our power, that I think there's a genuine fear that the colonial project will end. So to me, that's a fear that I'm about. You should be afraid, actually. Actually, you really should.
Okay, in Australia, is the Commonwealth fearful of Aboriginal people? From what you've heard, the discussions you've had with people, do we strike that same sort of fear into the Commonwealth's heart?
Yeah, I feel like when I think about that question, I think about what, in Canada specifically, the colonial project kind of had two folds, and it's similar for all of, most of our countries. It was the erasure, the ignoring, the pushing aside, the erasing, and the eradicating of Indigenous peoples in Canada, and it was bringing over enslaved Africans to work the land. So it took, it was a twofold. It was the exploitation and the erasure. And I think that the Commonwealth doesn't really actually think about the fact that Indigenous folks are still here, The erasure project, it wasn't complete. So I think that, countries like Canada actually, it's not even just that there's a fear, is that there's a literal denial that folks are still here, they're still thriving, folks are still building community, folks are saying, hey, like our issues matter as well. So I think that partly our governments in Canada specifically are still living in this fantasy reality world that Indigenous people just don't exist. And we see that in a variety of different ways. We see it in the ways that Indigenous organizers constantly have to repeat the same thing over and over and over and over again. Canada just recently celebrated our 150th anniversary. And I cannot tell you, in my time, in my over a decade in Canada, I've never seen more cultural content, more articles, more blog posts, more radio, more media done on one subject. I've never seen it. And it was Indigenous folks all across the land, First Nations, Inuit, and Métis folks, and allies, settlers, saying, yo, Canada's not 150 years old. This project, this like multi-million dollar project to celebrate Canada's 150th anniversary actually erases the tens of thousands of years that folks have lived on this country. And it's as if all of this work, when I tell you a whole year of cultural content, there was not a day that you can pick up the newspaper or watch the news and not hear about somebody doing some critical narrative interventions on that. And yet, we still sit there, and yet I can still talk to people, average Canadians, who still are like, oh, well, there's resistance against it. So I think that, Canadians really love to pretend like work isn't being done to educate them. And I think that that's a way of actually absolving ourselves of a responsibility to do something about it.
Yeah. Patrice, in the States, obviously a completely different set of political systems. Firstly, you guys met Barack Obama at the White House. Mm-hmm. When? Was that it? And we know it wasn't. Now, with 45 in, and this you may have to explain 45 to our audience, but that fear with Charlottesville, the reaction at Charlottesville, that's as present now as it was in the 80s with the war on drugs and all of that business. Can you give us a little bit of an idea of what it's like on the ground over there?
Yeah, I mean, it's not the same as the 80s, it's different. And we haven't lived under a fascist government before. And what we're seeing with 45, which is simply the 45th president, many of us have refused to say his name.
Voldemort.
So you'll hear we say 45. And 45 and his project is really, it's a backlash. It's in response to 8 years of a black president and 3.5 years of a black movement. And he really ran on the idea of old America, of white supremacist America, of the of what we call the underbelly of American society, and he won on that. And I think the part that the critical feedback for our movement is that we were too naive. We did not believe that he was going to become the president. I think too many of us were in our own bubbles. And it's not a judgment. It's like we all should have critical feedback of our movements. But it is definitely, there are moments, I think for us, especially the moment when he was elected, where we, you know, cried our eyeballs out, we're super depressed. It's still super depressing, but we feel like we have a clarity around what's next. But we sort of sat around tables for months, like, let's retrace. How did this happen? And it didn't happen in a year candidacy tour. It happened because of white America. Mm-hmm. White America was scared of black people. And we saw it. We saw it in their response to our movement. We saw it in the response and the lack of care and the lack of grace to our movement. And we saw it because they ended up voting in 45 as a president. I think what's equally powerful in this moment is the movement really was created and curated during a black presidency. And many of us met with Obama multiple times and were invited to the White House multiple times. But pretty much after like the third invite, it got real boring. Because you're like, three invites, one black person dying a day, it's not stopping, we're sitting around tables talking, like, this is not gonna work.
Yeah.
And so, by the third invite, the Black Lives Matter Network actually wrote a statement saying, we're not going to meet with him again. We're not meeting with you until we actually see real, concrete demands being met by black people. And he didn't meet those demands. And so we never met with him again. And I think what is powerful is we united around that. And in this moment, we're not just uniting around this sort of like move towards hating 45, even though that's incredibly easy. What we're actually trying to figure out in this moment is how do we build black power? Mm-hmm. And how do we build it electorally, but also how do we build the power of black people on the ground, some of the most marginalized black people on the ground? And that's what that work looks like in this moment. And it's, you know, it's a challenge. It's a challenge to be stateside right now. But having a movement like the Black Lives Matter Network allows for a new, revived conversation about what's next.
Yeah. In Canada, you have a handsome devil named Trudeau.
Yeah.
Is he... How good is he?
Oh, Lord. Trudeau. Before I got to Trudeau, I just wanted to ask, add one more thing to the Obama and Trump phenomenon. I grew up in the States. I lived in the great state of Florida during George Bush's reign, and it's really interesting for me to when you talk about the just the timeline and the trajectory, and thinking about when we left the States, we really were like, no, this isn't really the country for us. We came from a country that was hella black, Haiti. We really felt as if there were so many anti-black, anti-migrant, just general, the vibe for us of where we were at in our locale wasn't happening. And yet we felt, the irony during Obama's presidency is that everyone that I went to school with was quick to let me know that they voted for Obama. Like, that was often like, you know, white folks, that was like the fourth sentence that would be, you know, told, like, just so you know, I voted for Obama. But then the same folks again, and I'm on Facebook with a number of folks that I went to elementary and middle school with, were like quick to talk about Make America Great Again. So I think that for me, the lesson is around the ways that we actually, you know, the reason that white America were out galvanized voting for Obama wasn't really, I think, about change. It was about making themselves feel better that they voted in a black president. And we're more than okay to flip back to the old conservative, anti-black, and anti-immigrant culture that existed amongst their communities the second that they were like, job's done, we did it. Trudeau is frustrating. To be honest with you, Trudeau is very frustrating. He is a stark contrast to our old prime minister. And in fact, he really got elected because there was a big campaign that it was anything but Harper. And folks strategically voted in Trudeau because he comes from, like Bush, comes from a legacy political family. His dad was the prime minister. Under his dad, we saw the Multiculturalism Act get adopted. Canada really shifted its focus to be bringing in a number of migrants from different regions around the world. And I think wholeheartedly, a lot of marginalized communities, indigenous communities, black communities, really saw Trudeau as a savior, similar to Obama. The reality is Trudeau's term is going to be done in 2019, and you know, the man has great hair. I can say that. The man has a great PR team. He has a cute family. He dresses nicely, and that's really about it. We really were disappointed when imagine a politician running, you know, everyone has platforms, but your number one platform, right, is something that gets you elected. For Trudeau, it was electoral reform. He really wanted to get rid of first-past-the-post system. He really saw the damage that our electoral system had by electing Harper over and over and over again, even though Harper never really got the majority of the population. And he really ran and won on this belief that, yes, anything but Harper, you can have anything but Harper because I will create these changes the second I get into office. The second he got into office, the very first statement that came out from the Prime Minister's office was, actually, I don't think we can do that. I actually don't think it's a priority for Canadians. I'm sorry, like, you got elected, you know, like, people usurped, moved over the old regime who was in power for over 9 years because of this one promise that you had. And yet you feel like right after you got elected, before you consulted anyone, before you did any cross-country tour, before you actually took the job, that it's not a priority for Canadians. Who told you that? How? How did you know that it's not a priority for Canadians? And we've seen over and over and over again the different ways that Trudeau continues to disappoint. The ways that, you know, Trudeau continues to, the promises that he's given are actually quite empty. Under Trudeau's leadership, there is nothing that has changed federally about the conditions for black and indigenous communities. And I say that as a fact. I cannot tell you right now what is one transformative policy that Trudeau has brought us. I really can't. I can't even give him the benefit of the doubt. Trudeau promised weed legalization and decriminalization because he recognized the ways that black and indigenous folks who make up over 35% of the prison population, many of us are in prison for simple possession charges. But yet, you know, when legalization will happen by the end of this year, and that there's nowhere in there that it decriminalizes marijuana use, distribution, there's no aspect of decriminalization. In fact, the legalization now is restricting that, you know, you can smoke indoors in your house. That's about it. You know, we're going to actually shut down any dispensaries. Yeah. We're going to actually, as a government, we're going to control the market, and we are going to be making money off of big business. And in fact, there's a report that came out, and a number of the licenses for weed shops, you know, that are popping up are actually by, like, former cops, former bureaucrats, people that are big into his Liberal Party. So how can you trust somebody like that? How can you sit there and literally, politicians lie, we get that, we're not naive, but like, at least like wait a year before you change your thing. At least be a little bit more covert in the ways that we do it. I think that Trudeau teaches us a lesson that whether you have a charismatic leader like Trudeau, like Obama, whether you have a fascist like Trump, whether you have a stone cold conservative old guard like Harper, like the leaders are important, but really it's what's happening electorally. It's what's happening in the political undercurrents of our country that requires targeted approach and targeted organizing.
Targeted organizing. Speaking of targeted organizing, today you guys flew in after a hectic week. And we had a meeting out at the Aboriginal Advancements League in Thornbury. There was a turnout of young activists, advocacy groups. What did you hear? I'm trying to get to this. There was a strong contingent from our African brothers and sisters, and from refugees. There was also, obviously, a strong contingent of First Nations people. What's blackness? Like, I know in the Canadian context, it's difficult.
Yeah.
What is blackness? Perhaps for the audience, you could explain a little bit about what we're talking about when we're talking about black power.
Yeah, for sure. You want to take it? Yeah.
And then I'll give it back to you. Well, I think the first thing I want to say is there's a reason why we called it Black Lives Matter and not African American Lives Matter. Boring. And you know, we've had some Black Americans say, why isn't it African American Lives? But black is a political reference. Blackness is not just a quote racial identity, but it's also a political identity. And when we started Black Lives Matter, it was an intention to move away from the old guard, like the NAACP, Al Sharpton, Jesse Jackson, and their framework that really was, you know, denying a black diaspora in many ways, a framework that focused solely on black Americans voting, right? I heard that a lot growing up. If you just vote, no, it doesn't work like that. Voting is one tactic, but if you have no one to vote for, then yeah, many of us don't vote. It sounds like some people like that in the audience. You don't have to clap for everything. So I think, you know, there was a deep intention when we started Black Lives Matter to talk about blackness as a global phenomenon, anti-blackness as a global phenomenon, and more importantly, that black people around the world, we are part of a global black family. And there has been a long history of us struggling together, building together, exchanging together, having movement exchanges. We've seen that from Marcus Garvey, Malcolm X. We know that many folks traveled around the world in Black America and across the diaspora to have deep engagement about how we're going to relate to each other, how we're going to respond to each other. And this is important because when 45 was elected, it wasn't just a win for white people inside our country, white racists and white supremacists. It became a win for white nationalists across the world. And they were talking to each other, and they were excited about 45. And they were saying, this is a big deal for us. This gives our movement extra support. This provides our movement a new framework. And in fact, 24 hours later, the level of hate crimes rose up by 15%. White people were like, we won, and now we get to behave any way we want. And so, and we think about that, And we think about the legacy in which Black people across the world have been in relationship to each other. It is actually in our best interest to build Black political power and to build it globally. It is not in our interest to try to silo in our nations, although we need to be fighting back our own governments and the state in our own locales, but we have to push and challenge ourselves to align with one another. Because you could do it. Because if we don't, they do. They will, they have, and we see what ends up happening. And so this, you know, us coming over here was, and one part about the prize, but really it was about, all right, how do we sit with our folks? Like, what's really going on? How do we build together? What are the next steps? How are we having these really important organizer conversations? And we know the shit doesn't happen overnight. We know that it takes deep engagement, but blackness is a conversation that is about how do we build together.
Similarly, I think of blackness as a political home, as an umbrella in which Black folks of the Black diaspora all over the world can actually like find common ground and organize. So in the Canadian context, I always think that it's important to look at historically the ways that Black resistance has expanded and the ways that like our understanding of blackness has actually expanded to include more folks. For the longest time, blackness was seen as, you know, the descendants of enslaved Africans. They were folks who, when slavery was abolished in the British Empire, who settled into Nova Scotia and Acadia, the East Coast, who were seen as Black, and it was really the ethnic markers of Canada were the British, the French, First Nations, Inuit, and Métis folks, and then the others, Black folks. So we recognize that, you know, folks used to be enslaved in the States, folks used to be enslaved in Canada, mostly people recognize that we're under this umbrella. Then Canada started opening its doors for migration. And for the longest time, it really started with the Caribbean, primarily in Jamaica and Trinidad and Tobago, like the English-speaking Caribbean countries, started migrating to Canada. And had to resist folks that have been on the land for 100 years, 150 years, who were really holding on to this Black identity, and had to say, no, whether or not I was here for 100 years, or whether or not I just came, white folks are treating us the same. So our understanding of blackness expanded. Then in the 1960s, really onwards to the 1990s, there were massive waves of migration from other places, from Haiti, from Jamaica through the domestic workers program. And we start to see trickling in from the continent as well, as the decolonial processes started trickling in through the African continent. And then folks who were new migrants had to say, oh, no, you're talking about blackness, which I'm under that umbrella, but really you're doing work that's like regionally specific, that's only speak to your issues, you have to expand it in. So in the Canadian context, we've had to continually expand our understanding of blackness, because as we were organizing, we were recognizing that the landscape of our country were changing. Most recently, in the 90s, in the early 2000s, we've seen mass waves of a particular ethnic groups. Somalia, there were mass from after the Civil War. Yeah, Somalis in the audience. Whoop, you know. After the Civil War in Somalia, Somalis came in the tens of thousands to Canada, and had to really challenge their right to be included under the Black umbrella. Problematic, right? Had to really challenge the Black organizing and activism that was solely rooted in a Caribbean framework, that was solely rooted in an African-Canadian framework, to say, hey, I'm coming here as well, starting to experience poverty, having lack of resources, being targeted by police, expand your framework. So we've continually had to expand our understanding of blackness existing beyond ethnic boundaries, because so many of us identify with different ethnic markers. And for me, when I organize around, like with my Haitian folks, that is different from when I show up under the Black umbrella. When I organize around the Black umbrella, I recognize that it's not just Haitians coming to the fold, that it's Black indigenous folks, that is Black folks from the continent, that is Black folks who have lived on this in our country for 200 plus years, and who themselves have no connection to their ancestral homeland, who for themselves they are African Canadian. So it really has forced us to really challenge how wide and how big we can actually hold Black folks. It really forces us to challenge in ourselves with how particular, Canadians specifically, particular ethnic markers, specifically like Jamaican folks, African Canadians, tend to hold the narrative of Blackness and had to expand it, give space for more people to come. But we were talking about this having dinner as well. It really makes us think about how racially, race evolves, right? When Italians and Irish folks were coming to Canada, they weren't seen as white at first. They were seen as others. Whiteness has evolved. Whiteness has also expanded to take on more folks. Blackness has done the same as well. So to me, in the reflection back on the original question of the conversation that was happening at the community meeting, I really saw that space as an experimentation for where this community is going to be, the conversations that this community is going to be having in the next decade or so, really thinking about what are the spaces that need to be created for all the different ethnic markers under the Black umbrella to organize under one unified umbrella. That's difficult. It's difficult. But I think it was really great to see, because that difficulty is something that we're still actively doing.
I was pretty energized by the end of today. Mm-hmm. Fatigued, but you know, I got a lot of positivity out of, you know, the end, the end result. And I guess a lot of that is because First Nations advocacy groups and activists, we haven't interacted with our African brothers and sisters as well as we could have yet. But those networks started today. Mm-hmm. What were some of the things? There was a few breakout groups during today where, you know, groups of 25 were discussing stuff. What were some of the things that you heard from the people like that were there?
A lot of things. There was, it was special this morning. I'm so sad that we had to leave. Yeah. It was a really special morning. And one thing that stood out for me is like how much folks needed that space. And how I recognized, like, there was just this, like, we have not done this before. Like, how do we get in? How do we dig in? And there was also a lot of sadness. And I think it's important that we name grief and generational trauma. And when we have to be in a place that's predominantly white, a country that's predominantly white, and how much you have your backup, how much you don't realize you are, the tensions you're holding, how it impacts your psyche, your body emotionally, and when you finally get to be in a room where it's just your folk, and like how your body relaxes and you finally are like, I can cry now. I can feel how
there was a lot of that, wasn't
it? It was a lot of that. It was like, I can actually feel it's safe here, because the way trauma works, and part of our work is talking about trauma a lot. Trauma keeps the way we react keeps us safe. So part of the safety is like, you know, as folks of color, as Black folks, we have a shell. We're like, all right, gotta live in the world. The world doesn't like us. Like, I'ma hold this shell, and there's only a few places where I can release. And I felt like today was a place of release. And I heard a lot of folks ask and talk about healing justice, talk about self-care. How do you do this work holding generational trauma and being disrespected on a daily basis? How do you be inside of the work? And I think that those are questions that I wish my elders would have positioned for me earlier on. Yeah. Very much so, you know, I was trained by a generation of folks that were trained in the Black Liberation Movement, and it was a very go-go-go culture. You didn't talk about your feelings much, you just went, you know, you did the campaign. And what I appreciate about this generation is we're all about our feelings.
sometimes too much. But we talk, you know, we process a lot. And I think it's, you know, it might be on the other end of the pendulum, but I do think there's a balance there, which is like, how do we situate the PTSD that we hold that's really real for us and also take on the state? How do we do that in a way that does not deplete us? How do we do that in a way that makes sure that our folks don't end up committing suicide? How do we do that in a way that positions us to imagine Black people as alive and not just dead? And so I got that in our circle today. I just felt the like need of, for like, we have to be doing this. And the other piece, which is like, folks don't get to feel because they're too, you know, we are too busy like trying to hold it down.
Functioning.
Yeah. I generally felt that there was in our circle, we similar things. Like where it was really, you always feel when you come into a space and there's charged energy, like you feel it right away. And it kind of, I was telling folks when I left, that like my adrenal glands were pumping. Like it was just like adrenaline. I was moving, I was buzzing around, and partly it's because I was feeling the energy of my circle. And I think that one of the things that keeps coming back to me is that there is a thirst to be building out movement relationships here like there's never been seen before. Mm-hmm. There was a thirst, you know, folks that I saw so many different places, faces from different, not only ethnic markers, from different communities, from different experiences, First Peoples to new migrants.
And to ages.
So there was just a thirst to really look at each other and have a conversation and like, what is it that we're building? How do we build together? And I remember when we, and in the initial stage of forming our chapter, a number of us, when we got together, it was because we felt like there was literally nothing else left to do. We had no idea what we were doing, no idea what we were building. A number of us were organizers in different spheres, and it was just, what is this that keeps bringing us back together? It's because the energy really just forced us to kind of keep moving and doing it. And I felt a little bit of that. I felt like there was a feeling that people, it wasn't like, oh, we know, you know, hey, this is plan A, plan B, let's move on. It wasn't that. It was, no, we really want to see each other a bit more. We really want to connect and really want to build a movement that speaks to the realities of our generation.
There was an exuberance there, wasn't there?
Yeah.
I got there a little earlier than you guys today, and you know there was that reticence and reluctance and the worried about boundary and a couple of groups sitting at different spots. And then by the end of it, there was an exuberance. There was lots of smiles. Mm-hmm. There was lots of, you know, numbers and cards being exchanged, which, mm-hmm. you know, I'm glad that it happened, and it could have gone any way, though.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah.
But just to get onto the, I guess, the organising thing, where do we go from there? Like, when we were in Mildura, it was the first place that you guys were really exposed to some of the things, the complex of First Nation issues, a lot of them stemming from intergenerational trauma. And ironically, that day or the day before you guys arrived, we had the Prime Minister Turnbull reject the Uluru Statement. Yeah. And whether you support it or not, it was a self-determined cry or, they were demanding, they demand some decision-making roles and a voice to be heard. The PM rejected it. Then we arrived in Mildura and we heard from a number of community-led programs, and they're all self-determining, driven decision-making roles, and they were all pretty successful. Mm-hmm. So I guess my question is, with knowing a little bit of the answer, what do we do from that exuberance today with the knowledge that we've got that these programs have to be community-led? How deep do we go in organizing?
As deep as y'all can go. Mm-hmm. I think that for me, I orient myself from a model of disciplined, sustained, and informed organizing. I'm going to start backwards. Informed means organizing that connects with community. Informs means organizing that's just not out of thin air. You know, feeling the again, like we said, the energy of your people to do something, and that's the reason you do it. Sustained, recognizing that we're building movements and not moments, and that we can have moments, like there can be spurts and bursts of energy, but really the more that we can sustain, the more that we're able to build power. The more that we can sustain, the more that we can build strong relationships with each other, the more that we can sustain, the strong that we get. And disciplined organizing. I came into organizing, and I use organizing and activism distinctly because I recognize that organizing is like a lifelong process, and it recognizes the ways that we need to be disciplined. One of the things that I rarely throw compliments to the U.S., but I'm going to do it. I think that one of the things that I really look at the U.S. a lot is their history of disciplined organizing. You know, we know that the Panthers, like they were all about educating themselves. Like the Panthers were required readings. It was like important for folks to be raising not only our analysis but skill building as well. And every time I go to the U.S., I'm like, y'all are about like your like political education is big. You know, like leadership development is massive. Training is massive. You know, it means looking at, although I've been organizing for over 10 years, after this, I have a facilitation training that I'm going to. You know, I found funding to go and to literally sit and to be taught by folks that are experts on like facilitation techniques. It's not that I haven't facilitated before. It's in recognizing that I'm still constantly learning. That although I consider myself experienced in the work that I do, I'm constantly learning and constantly building. So to me, I feel like there's the work that happens behind the scenes in this movement. You know, we see the actions, we see the pop-offs, we see the stuff that gets the international attention, but the stuff that happens actually behind the scenes are often a lot group political education, a collective study, teaching each other skills. There are folks, you know, on my team that like are really dope with media and have, you know, done and created curriculum for everybody to get it. It's about like exchanging in the ways that our people have done for so long. Our people have always done this, you know? Like Haitians, you're like, if you don't know how to fish, but you live in a fishing town and fishing is a requirement for you to survive and thrive, you're bringing folks in to learn how to fish. I think we need to really go back to not only are we building power to smash the state and to break down systems, but we build power by building each other up.
Yeah, and a lot of, yeah. Today, I want to get you to bring something up. You said initially Black Lives Matter was about shutting shit down.
Mm-hmm.
And that was necessary, and it was a strategic tactic. Probably still is, but there were four other things.
Mm-hmm.
Can you give us a...
Yeah.
What are these things?
So direct action and like rapid response and mobilization is what we're most known for. It's what most of us, in the origin years, 2013, 2014, those are the things that really brought us in. But for us, we recognize that it's also important to be doing strategic interventions. So that strategic interventions can be anything from lobbying to policy work to sitting on committees to doing electoral justice projects. It's thinking strategically, what are the interventions that we can do to work inside and outside of the system? It's disciplined organizing, like I mentioned, sustained and disciplined organizing. That is, you know, thinking about not only are we building movements, but we're building ourselves. Informed community programming, you know, that's the best way I can think about it, is like doing community work that builds each other up. So for us, that is doing things like, you know, hosting a freedom school, because we recognize that it's important to be bringing up young generation of leaders. It's important for us to be in community. We can't just always be like lobbying and pushing the man. We can't always just be in white spaces talking about give us our lives. We have to also be in community building each other up. And it's about working in an affirmative framework, recognizing that we're all working to build blackness, black power. Part of that is celebrating ourselves. part of that is celebrating Black joy. Part of that is saying, you know what, I'm just gonna not talk about death today. I'd rather talk about the dope work that Black folks are doing in my community. We kind of see our work falling into five of those umbrellas, and part of it, to be honest, is selfishly so we can continue to do this work.
Yeah.
After a while, oh my gosh, rapid response is exhausting. After a while, you're like, okay, well, like, the success isn't hosting an action. It's about getting change done. But hosting actions, you know, the first couple of years when we were out on the streets, like, all the time, is exhausting. A number of our comrades and a number of our folks are just tired. They don't organize anymore because you can only get called those so many times. You can only see your name spewed. You can only receive hate mail so many times. If we're not doing the other four stuff, this work will break us down.
And we heard, when we went to Mildura, I deliberately wanted you guys to see something. Mm-hmm. And that was the community programs. And when we were discussing it later, Patrice, you said that you guys were conscious of the fact that you needed to work both inside and outside the system. But you said that in the States, you weren't at that level of working within the system in a revolutionary, resistant way. Is there something that us Black fellows can give to you?
Mm-hmm. Oh, always. Yeah, I think the question becomes for us, will every project work both ways, right? Like, what aspects of the work that we do would work here? What aspects of the work that you do works there? And I've been thinking about it a lot since our trip, because we do have a big restorative justice framework in the States and a growing transformative justice framework. And then another piece is just a growing community accountability framework. And in some ways,
Can you break this down?
Yeah, I was about to. The RJ framework, the restorative justice framework, really does come out of Indigenous communities and this idea that we can restore relationships. And that's very simple, but people intervened in that specifically in Black communities where there's nothing to restore. That actually we have to transform the very way that the state interacts with us and we interact with the state. And then folks had in that space took it a bit further because we were trying to think about, well, how do we hold, if there's this huge, you know, conversation about harm and violence in our communities, and there's real harm and violence happening, but we don't want to rely on the state to hold our communities accountable. So we started creating models around community accountability and figuring out what are the best ways we can hold each other accountable so that we can still be in relationship to one another. The trick is this, though, because our police and prison state is so wedded to the decimation of our communities, there are some places where the restorative justice framework is trying to be and attempting to be utilized within the state, but it still heavily relies on the state to give the verdict, to respond to the person inside, you know, similar to y'all. Folks have to plead guilty, right? And so it complicates this conversation about self-determination. And while for me, I'm a prison abolitionist, I do not believe that prisons, police, or courts should exist. There are some ways in which I do think that there's power in having these RJ or restorative justice spaces inside court systems. Mm-hmm. Because for us, especially as abolitionists, anything that we can do to make sure that our folks are free. Yeah. And I think that's what was powerful about Mildura, is sitting around this table with these elders as they're literally breaking down the mechanics of what it looks like to be in a curry court. Mm-hmm. And what it looks like to, like, you know, magistrate aside, it's you and your kin, and you're having a real talk conversation. And I can't even imagine us being able to do that inside the United States. And I think it was this sort of moment where, like, what power can come from, even within the construct of the state, to be able to, like, have it as a loose container where you can have a real talk conversation with your family member and be like, yo,
let me tell you something about this. Like, you don't want to get caught up in this.
Yeah.
And we're going to be your buffer, you know, and we're going to like, we're going to make sure to steer you in the right direction. And the power in the Curry Courts isn't just that moment that they are inside of the state trying to like figure it out. It's what happens afterwards, mm-hmm. which all those folks get supported by elders. And I think that is like, that was like something that I've been just like teasing apart. Like, could we do something like that stateside?
Still a long way to go with that Curry Court, though. We did hear, like we've spoken of it pretty, you know, brightly tonight. But we heard the flaws, like from the guys that are working in the, you know, with that program. Look, as my good friend Gary Foley says, it is with a heavy heart. We've got 5 minutes left, and I've been informed that we're allowed to go 5 minutes over. So I want to throw to the audience, and particularly, I've been told that we've got some microphones either midpoint or down the front. Oh, we're going to have a roaming microphone. Ah, nice, nice.
That's
again, going from today and meetings leading up to today, we want to hear from people of colour in the questions tonight.
Yeah.
It's not a segregation thing. It's a positive thing.
Yes.
We all know that at these events.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And it happens in our context as well. Yeah. Say it, Jeff.
So, questions.
Hey, Mama Dosa, I have a question. How are you?
Hi.
I was wondering, say for the creative people in the audience who are sort of trying to incorporate this work into our art or music or whatever else we're doing. I'm just sort of, part of the reason I'm here is to sort of get some inspiration for that. So, yeah, I'll just leave it open-ended like that.
Our movement actually has a lot of artists. We ourselves, like I'm not a career organizer. I'm a dancer and a choreographer, performance artist here, actually doing her MFA currently. So recognizing that, we recognize that our art and our activism aren't separated, and we actually are deliberate about inserting our art in our work. I think that there's a way that people can digest our messaging a little bit easier if it's done in a creative way. There's a way that people's backs kind of chill a little bit more if you're incorporating artistic elements in them. So for us, it comes through a variety of different ways. Our actions always have a creative component. They always have. Like, it's always, whether it's in the visual, like the aesthetic of what it is, incorporating music and dance, incorporating like what we call Black joy into it, targeted and inserting in artists or voices that we feel are missing in mainstream arts in our communities. But it's also about like creating cultural content as well. Outside of just actions and shutting shit down, we have often artists in our communities that are really doing dope work. They're doing fantastic work that needs amplification. And we recognize that like we have a platform to amplify that. We have a platform to connect people together. We do that all the time. It's like, actually, you're doing this work. We think y'all should get together. And in fact, we know this person that does really good fundraising. That person can help you apply for grants, pull it together. So I think that don't shy away from using your art and inserting it in. And don't shy away from using movement spaces as a way to also teach each other about our art practice as well. Some of our artists have hosted like internal teach-ins. So one of our visual artists was like, yo, like I do a lot of large scale drawings. Like let's do an internal teach-in on like silk screening and like ways of using drawing and visuals. I'm a movement artist. So we often are like, oh, like let's just like get together and just like have a little informal dance session that just teaches us about how to use our bodies and about relaxing and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that the question that you said is right on point. Don't actually shy away from it. Be deliberate about the way that you insert your art into your activism.
It's about communication and exchange,
yeah.
Essentially, right?
Absolutely.
And health.
Absolutely. And it's like, really, I'm like, you can push the envelope in the narrative that you're saying it if it's enfolded in within art. It's like tricking your tricking folks in a bit, right? People get their backs defensive when you're like saying things like white supremacy, white nationalism, white. But like, you know, talking about white supremacy and white nationalism through an artistic medium, like in a way people are like, oh, that's nice. You know, the delivery of it is nice because art is something that transcends everyone. You know, like even white supremacists, human beings as a whole connect to arts in a way. So yeah, be deliberate about the way that you use it.
White supremacists are getting all their rapping and stuff. Aren't
they? I mean, they do.
They do. It's really deeply unfortunate.
And like,
stay away from my art.
Like hella tacky too.
Exactly.
If you could just go quick, because I do want to get, well, I've got 5 minutes, so. If you've got a response.
Yeah, one response for you is connect with the other artists in this space. The best way that I've been able to continue to utilize my art inside this movement is actually like building with other artists. And so sometimes as artists, we really we're really individual. We're like, I'm gonna do this great poem
for the movement. I'm into my arts right now.
Exactly. And I would just actually encourage to self-organize.
Cool, we got another one.
Hi, yeah. Speaking of art and how we use it as a way of organizing and activism here, I grew up in Atlanta. I've just lived in Melbourne for the past year. But I think that oftentimes the way that we see ethnic folk and people of color getting a voice in Melbourne is through white art spaces. Mm-hmm. And then what you guys spoke about this afternoon in terms of seeing people coming together and finally having a time of like, oh shit, like I get to be here, mm-hmm. and I get to release. I feel like the unfortunate thing about using art as this liberatory practice is that when it functions in a white space, you don't actually get to have mm-hmm. that release. And so I was wondering what suggestions you guys would make for people of color continuing to make work in such white spaces and not having to do that thing of like, let me set down the fact of my humanity before I then allow myself to express where I'm coming from and how to create and cultivate in that context.
Yeah, I mean, I'm doing an MFA and I'm the only black person in my cohort, so gotcha. Which makes me just feel even more blacker. I'm like, I'm gonna do the blackest shit in this program. So just do the blackest shit. Like, seriously, yeah. Like,
Black.
I think in these moments, especially when you're having to deal with a white space, literally, and white spaces, it actually allows for black people, black artists in particular, to like tap into our rage, our sadness, our frustrations, and utilize that, and utilize it to project what you wanna see and how you wanna see it, because you're not making art for white people. I'm not making art for white people. I'm making art for me and my people. Yeah. And not enough of us in the fine art world get to actually speak for ourselves and have something influence and be a mirror for our folks.
And I'll say really quickly that I like producing art, and I don't really have the skill in the curating producing in like the, you know, when you're producing a show, not just like making the art. One of the things that I found has been really dope in our community is like the art makers have been able to link with black curators, producers, people who like can actually shape it together. And Cyrus Marcus Ware, who's an artist in Toronto, does this really well because he is a dope curator. So he will go to art galleries and he's like, it's not that you need to program black art, it's that you need to give me the money that you would have done for this exhibition so I can program black art. So we also, you know, tying yourself up if you're an art maker with like black folks who are really good at like the grants, the money, the putting it together, because if we're actually controlling the art from not only the making of it, but how it's seen, which spaces it's seen, then like it'll be done with a gaze for your people.
And we heard from Soretti today, mm-hmm. who said something along those lines.
Yeah.
Just give it over.
Just give it over, you know?
All right, I think we've got time for one more. So this one here. Wherever the people. Well, maybe two. Can we get first you and then you? That'll have to be it.
Okay. Oh, sorry. So I just wanted to ask. Can I hold it there? Sorry. I just wanted to ask what both your views are on the relationship between economics and racism in America but also around the West. I think a criticism you hear from some black activists like Ta-Nehisi Coates is that white liberals focus too much on economics and not the role racism plays, especially race hate. Is it hate or is it something worse like apathy, where the white establishment don't actually care about the consequences that their economic policies have on people of colour around the world?
We sort of discussed this, didn't we, about the absorption, the co-opting.
I think it's fear and laziness. And I say fear because we had this discussion about white people literally being afraid of black people taking back what we deserve. And I say laziness because I think it's easy. It's easy to not fight against a system that you're privileged by. It's easy to not want to dismantle a thing that you get resources from. And I think this idea of hate is really, it's too simplified. I think it's fine and digestible in the comms world. You're like, it's really good, you know, comms word, like, they hate us. But it's like way bigger than hate. And those tweets that you witness, that's a sickness. That's bigger than hate. That's historical. Hate you can like easily have a conversation about, and we can do a dialogue. This is generations and generations of people being trained that we are literally inferior, that we do not deserve to live, that we do not deserve to survive. That's something different that needs to be literally uprooted.
What she said.
And just, we had somebody...
Second row right here.
Yeah.
Yep. Yes.
Sorry, I've got the lights in my eyes. I can't see.
Hello again, guys.
Hi.
Kayla here. Mm-hmm. So I want to thank you again so much for this morning. It was really great to have you guys there and come and speak to us. So after we left, I rang my son. He's 10 years old. And he's away with my family, and all week I kind of kept from him like what I was going to be doing this weekend, because he'd already gotten a bit of, I guess, we had a bit of controversy with his school this week about him trying to school his teacher about frontier wars here in Australia, because they're learning about World War Wars at the moment, and he's like, well, there was things here. I know, my boy. And I'm just wanting to know, like, I work with young people, and being very aware that I'm a single mum of a young black man here in Australia, mm-hmm. that I don't always surround him with my thoughts and mm-hmm. the way that I point, like, give my point across, mm-hmm. because I want him to be a child. I want him to be a 10-year-old, but when he's coming home and talking about conversations about assassinating number 45 with, like, all of his, like, friends at school who are of colour or are of different religions, it's really hard because violence becomes so normalised. Like, how do we protect our younger generation who are going to come through? And how does that work for you guys over in America?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Good question to end on.
Very good question.
Yeah. I'm going to say a few things on this. Yes, we have to protect our children, but white people have to like actually raise their children not to kill us. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We often, as oppressed people, we take responsibility for everything. And while yes, educating our child, right, around their safety and the world that they live in and how it's dangerous for them. I know I received that talk. I know Rodney received that talk. Mm-hmm. Many of us received the talk. The other talk should be happening as well, where white parents should be raising their children to not hate us. And I think that there is, I've heard this a lot also with, you know, women saying this, right? This idea that if we just dress this way or this way, that we'll be safe. We can't be safe from racism. We can't be fully safe from patriarchy, from homophobia, from transphobia. The system still exists. And so the question really falls back onto white folks. How are you gonna keep us safe? How are you gonna ensure our safety so that we don't have to keep protecting ourselves?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, like, this is really hard because I feel like it's individual depending on who you would ask. I think about my upbringing as a child and the ways that my parents, when I was in Haiti, my parents taught me to be a rebel, to question things, to see my liberation. The second I moved to the States, it was the opposite. My parents really enforced like a responsible, respectable framework in me. It was, you know, learn this cadence of English and not this version of Black American slang. Learn this, dress like this, don't sag your pants, because, you know, in their heads, that was the only thing that they could tell me to survive. And I don't blame them for that. I think it's whatever you feel like will keep your child alive, will let your child survive. Having said that, I also have been very impressed by children's ability to actually grasp and understand these complex things. I think about Soraya. Soraya is one of our movement children. Soraya's 4, just turned 4. And Soraya's like, actually, like, I don't even understand. Like, the ways that, like, she's able to articulate, no, this is how I feel about this. I actually think that it's actually important for education system to do this. Like, the ways that Soraya is able to articulate her needs, what's wrong and what's right, really comes from Soraya's child, a parent, Leroy, framing the conversation around affirming rather than, like, smashing. I think it's like thinking about what is it that, like, you know, always, he's always like, your life is beautiful. Your beautiful Black life means this. You have a right to freedom. You have a right not to be imprisoned. You have a right not to be called this. Rather than, like, in his framework is not, you know, when you get called this, do this. It's like, you have a right not to get called this. So then Soraya knows, when I get called this, I have a right not to get called it. So I think that there's ways that we can reframe it around children, and I think that there are ways that we can actually hold children's capacity to understand these, but ultimately it's about survival. It's about context, and I don't blame my parents for the ways that they impose respectability on me, because they really saw that as the only way that I can survive. And I also want to say that the more that we can have our children be around each other, you know, the more that we create Freedom School, because we recognize that there's a lot of schooling in Toronto that's hella white, and that it's important to be creating a space where Black children can come together and share space and do the regular adolescent things, get in behavioral issues, you know, yell at each other, love each other, hug each other, kiss each other, do whatever. It was important for us to create a space where Black children can see themselves as a way of affirming their experiences in existence.
Brilliant. Folks, it is with a heavy heart. Look, before we thank these guys, I haven't been given any housekeeping in terms of who to thank, but I guess Wheeler Center, Rushstone Foundation, for getting these guys here. Also, I'd like to thank Indigenous X for giving me the opportunity to be hanging out with these guys.
Thank you.
And please follow Indigenous X if you haven't already, please. When are you guys coming back? Can we get you over again soon?
I mean, go ahead.
Folks should come over. We should do an exchange.
Yeah, I think we talked about really just, we are interested in doing deep movement building with folks. So thinking of this not just a moment, but really doing an exchange that gets us to understand our locales and really starting to experiment on this conversation on global anti-Blackness. The great thing is that y'all summer is our winter. So in
we
Canada,
I love
escaping our winter. So I think that there's some geographical advantages
we
for us.
We don't do cold, right?
Yes. Although right. It's cold here in Melbourne.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening to the Wheeler Center podcast. Don't forget to visit wheelercenter.com for the best in books, writing, and ideas from Melbourne, Australia, and the world.